Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Health Hacks Podcast. Today I'm joined by Bobby of Bobby Nutrition. And the reason I wanted to kick off with this episode in particular, and the reason I wanted to chat to Bobby, was irrespective of whether we are conscious of it or not, every single person on the planet has a diet. And whether you're aware of it, whether you're following an active dieting protocol or not, every single one of us does have a pattern of eating. We consume food. It's how we survive. So in that vein, if every single one of us has a diet, everyone in turn has a relationship with food. And that relationship can be very varied from, shall we call it a spectrum or a sliding scale of those who have a really positive relationship with food to others. It may be a barrier, however. And on the extreme of that spectrum, some of us find that we have an almost all-encompassing or all-consuming relationship with food that can actually, in its extremities, become quite debilitating to someone's life. It can really take over. Which leads me to ways of considering and correcting that relationship with food. And like I said, I wanted to start with this topic, and I can't think of any better person to talk to than Bobby to dive into this. Bobby is a coach. He leads the team at Bobby Nutrition, Team Excellence. He's a podcast host himself. He's a father, and he works closely with his clients who struggle with mindsets around emotional eating to equip them with the tools and support they need to take control of their eating and ultimately take control of their lives. And aside from that, he's just a bloody great human. How are you?
Good. What an intro, man. That's great.
I gave it a bit of thought because I went on your podcast this morning. It was a really good listen. And I love your message. I love everything that you do. We met during the summer, and I think you're a wonderful person. So I think to get you on and having a chat through this would be a really, really good deep dive in today. So do you want to start with a little bit for those who maybe aren't familiar with you, Bobby? They will be after this, but for those who aren't, do you want to give us a little bit of a background to you, how you ended up working with the clients that you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So with Bobby Nutrition, our demographic is it's quite specific actually. We work mostly with females. Now, people who come through the door, that's not always the case, but 95%+ of the time it is. But in terms of who our message is directed towards, it's a very specific woman who has tried every single diet under the sun. And for the life of her, she cannot figure out why she just cannot stick to something. And the reason for that is that whether she realizes it or not, what is driving her so-called negative relationship with food is actually what is a lot more unconscious. And more often than not, it goes back to childhood trauma and trauma in general along the way. And so that's who we work with at the moment. We have an incredible team of coaches headed by Emma, who is my head of coaching. Right now we are running with I think like 100 clients at the moment. And how did it all start? Kind of by accident, because I was like your typical science and evidence-based guy who wanted to help a previous version of himself. Like, who doesn't, right? You want to help the person that you used to be, you know, through what you used to struggle with. And I would try to help like this relatively nice dude, needed a bit more education on nutrition, blah, 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 blah. Very standard. I think it is these days anyway. So it was kind of niche then, but that got boring quite quickly. And once I then started talking a lot more, and I'm sure we'll touch on this, about my alcoholism and my very negative relationship with alcohol and how I overcame that, how I managed it, all the tools that I put in place, what then happened as a byproduct of that is that this very specific woman started approaching me and started saying, well, that's exactly what I have, except it's with food. So then when I put two and two together and got four, it was that the general psychological understanding is that outside of the ramifications that the use of this coping mechanism may bring to that individual or their surroundings and their family and friends, the coping mechanism doesn't really matter that much. It's just a coping mechanism. It's what's driving the desire unconsciously to need that coping mechanism that we need to focus on. And that's what we do.
Okay. Bobby, you talked a little bit there and you touched on it about your alcoholism. How do you feel that that has equipped you as a coach, as a person, to be able to talk directly to these women? Because if anyone has ever jumped on your social media or listened to your podcast, in fact, you have this ability to almost hit someone in between the eyes with the way that you talk to them, the language that you use. And it really comes from I believe, a deep understanding of knowing where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
How has your experience equipped you, do you think?
I think a mentor of mine one day, going back some time now, he said to me, once you understand your own story, you will be able to understand everyone else's. And of course, everybody has their own story. But once you take the time to, and this is why I believe I was eventually successful with my management of alcohol, was that, well, before I was successful, the reason I would relapse left, right, and center was because I was trying to avoid everything still. And alcohol being one of those things, I was just trying to avoid it. But it's because I didn't realize what was internally driving that requirement to try to escape from reality. And I took the approach of understanding what was driving all of that. And that takes a bit of understanding how the brain functions. It takes a bit of trying to learn about how our nervous system functions. And at more of a, let's say, maybe a woo-woo level, understanding, like we hear this term values thrown around a lot these days. But when we get really raw with what our values are, and we rip them out of our lives, as Mark Manson describes them, it's like a breakup, that because these values that have carried you all this way through life, like a partner, they could be toxic for you, but they've still always been there. So it's difficult to let go of them. But once you go through that raw, gut-wrenching process, you really, really, really learn a lot about yourself. And then when you do that enough, and you speak to enough people, you can just see that there's just themes throughout everyone. When I jump on a call with somebody now, I've never spoken to them before. I will speak to them for 5 minutes and I already know what the story is going to be. I know exactly where I'm taking the conversation. Again, not to undermine anybody's story, but there's always a pattern. And when you can look at yourself in that holistic perspective and you speak to more and more people, we spoke about how can we be practical with how we apply these things. I think practically that's how I do it. What's happened slowly over time is I've gathered more and more evidence from different types of people. And then I've been able to create this. I'm able to kind of subcategorize everything. So when they talk about this, this is probably what's happening. If they're talking about this, this is probably what's happening. And because I've done that so deeply with myself, I'm able to then apply it to other people. That's what I'd like to think.
Amazing. Bobby, when you're talking to these ladies, let's talk about get inside your head and the way that you coach women. When you're sitting in front of individual ladies and you're hearing these patterns come out, and there are, as you frame it, similarities in the stories. They may not be, you know, carbon copies, but the same themes are coming through in the conversations that you're having.
Mm-hmm.
It begs me to ask the question, and I'll ask the question about surrounding food, although I know you're coming at it from alcohol.
Yeah.
Why do we, zooming out slightly, why do we fundamentally have such a bad relationship with food? Why is it that this affects so many women?
Because food, first of all, let's approach it less from a food perspective and approach it more from a body perspective. So I think the problem with food is, first of all, food's super accessible. and it's tasty as hell. So if we want to get sciencey about it, you know, the reward system that we have dates back to our Paleolithic ancestors. So people often talk about being addicted to sugar, for example. And I understand what they mean. They're not addicted to sugar, but I'm not pedantic with people about that because I understand where they're coming from. What they actually mean is they love the combination of sugary things with fats. And the combination of those two macronutrients, let's say, not that sugar is one, but for the sake of this conversation, it is. With the combination of those two, it was super rare to come by back in the day. So evolution dictated that, well, this is a reward. So that's why it stimulates the brain so heavily. So our brain hasn't really evolved since then. It's pretty much exactly the same brain. So the problem is that we have a brain that's designed to treat these foods as rare rewards when we can actually buy it for 50, well, not 50p anymore. Maybe back when we were young, you could buy a Freddo for 10p, you know? Those days are long gone, but you can get a Freddo for whatever it is, £1.50 in the local convenience store now. So it's at your fingertips. And when you combine that with what is a general Western, it's a societal problem, which is workaholism and the general rat race. And there's a lot of, we live through automation. It's part of our neurological design. And when a society is structured in a specific way and a culture is structured in a specific way, we do what our friends do and we do what mum and dad did and so forth and so forth and so forth. So it carries on and it goes round and round and round and round. And sure, that culture evolves slowly over time, but it's still a culture and we will echo and we will try to fit into what everybody else is doing. It's natural. It's comfortable. We don't like being uncomfortable. It doesn't sit right with our neurology. So what has come with that, especially with this, you know? So whether it's work, whether it's TikTok scrolling, so whether it's social media consumption, our dopamine system is being rewarded left, right, and center. So we're being stressed by everything left, right, and center. We've got access to everything left, right, and center. So we're constantly being stimulated. We need something to relieve us of that stimulation. We have to. And this is where people, a lot of the time, they'll call themselves weak and they'll feel guilty when they eat certain foods because it's not part of the plan, you know? But the reality is that they just don't realize that they are living in, their nervous system is fucked. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to swear on this. You can blank it out later.
Go for it.
Our nervous systems as a society are so dysregulated that we're just trying to regulate ourselves through alcohol and through tasty foods. When it comes to specifically women, the issue there is that I wouldn't argue that the relationship with food in women is 10 times worse. I think it's just highlighted 10 times more because women aren't allowed to look fat relative to men. That's just the reality. That's the culture that we live in. So society throws it in women's faces relative to men. That's where it stands. So that's getting better, but it's nowhere close to where it needs to be. So we don't accept fat people, and we don't accept fat women, especially, because it doesn't fit, you know, society's beauty standards. So what then happens is that naturally, these women will be reminded of this in some way. They might go on Instagram and there's loads of so-called beautiful people on there. And without even realizing it, they're triggered. And then they want to escape the body that they're in, but they can't because, you know, you can't do that straight away. And then maybe there's pressure from mum, you know, because she's been on a diet her entire life. So then she'll come round to the house. You want a nice catch up, but all she can bang on about is why haven't you lost weight yet? Or, should you be eating that? How's the diet going? Because she's putting her diet culture onto you. So it's coming at these women from all angles all the time. And then this is the irony in it, is that the only thing that can soothe the pain that all of that brings is more food. And then so they'll eat more food and then they'll put more weight on, and then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, I'm just sitting here nodding my head, Bobby, because I couldn't agree with this anymore. I mean, one of the things you said, it's essentially this societal hamster wheel, isn't it? You get stuck on it, and it's this continuation of, it's that negative feedback loop. I mean, I've had clients who have, you know, worked with us on a program, and they've been making positive changes to their lifestyle. You know, they've sat down in the office, or they've gone out for dinner, or they've gone round to a friend's house, they've made a dietary choice that would be seen as positive, only to be met with criticism. Why are you eating like that? Why are you eating like a rabbit? What's that hamster? That kind of thing. And you think, people really do. There is no obvious way out of that. And I don't say that to sound doom and gloom. I say it because it's true. It's fundamentally a difficult position to be in for women. And there is a lot of strings pulling them in numerous different ways.
Yeah. When we... people are so convinced, and this is a conversation that goes just outside of weight. It's a conversation that we can take into promotions at work. We can take it to when we start a family. And it's this conversation of when I lose the weight, when I get that promotion, when I have the husband or wife, when I have the kids. You know, I see it all the time when people will start families. They'll bring kids into the world without no. I'm not trying to be harsh, because they don't realize this. It's a completely natural reaction, which is, this is fucked, my relationship. So let's bring something in to excite it a bit. And then we'll have children. And then we're distracted by the raising of the children. Then the children grow up. And exactly the same problems that we left behind 18 years ago, believe it or not, are still there. And we do this with everything. You know, we do it with promotions. So when I get that promotion, I'll finally be happy then. You know, and I'd imagine that's your client, right? So very, very work-driven. And it's good to be driven by work. You and I are. We wouldn't be where we are without it. But I think what we have to question really seriously is the values that are actually driving it, because a lot of the time we're not even aware of it. So my point is that if you absolutely adore something and you genuinely, fundamentally, wholeheartedly, with every fiber of your being, believe that accountancy is your purpose, go for it, right? Accounting, rather. So something that I could never fathom, because I'm not a numbers guy, but you know, it will be for people. So that's amazing. You found something that just suits your mind. It suits how you were brought. It suits everything to you. And you believe that you can change the world for it. It doesn't matter what that thing is then. Then, as a byproduct of the natural effort that you are always going to put into that thing, you are going to be rewarded. You are going to be promoted. And that's great. You know, kind of like a bonus. My challenge to the whole promotion sector of any industry is that if that person, without even realizing, is actually such a workaholic, because they believe if they were not to work that hard, they're worth nothing, that's what I have a problem with. And that's what I fundamentally believe most people in that position are suffering from without even realizing, coming back to a consequence of this rat race that we're all living through. So what we know is, and I experience this with my clients all the time. So my so-called high-performing clients, they come to me and they're like, Bobby, like I get everything else nailed in life. I'm a great mum. The kids are great. The job is fantastic. I'm a director, I'm a VP, I'm this, that, and the other. It's just the food. I can't manage the food. And it's the same answer every single time. And it's that the trauma driving their desire to be enough at work is exactly the same trauma that's driving their relationship with food. It's the same thing. Because what's happened more likely than not is, along the line, mum and dad have planted the seed that results matter. And what we have to understand and what we have to be careful of when we're parenting is that we can have the best intentions in the world for our kids. And it's quite a natural thing to do, to say, work hard. You know, it's a completely natural, because we want to make sure that they're safe and they're financially safe. We don't want them to struggle. So it's a completely natural parental instinct, especially if, as a parent, you might have come from nothing and education saved you. You will then project that onto your kids as well, because it's what saved you, that security that you then feel. You then instill that within the child. And as well-intentioned as that can be, it can be quite dangerous if we're not careful. Because a child doesn't think in the logical manner in which we intend the message to the child. So the intention from the adult is, if you work hard at this, you will be financially secure and, you know, everyone's happy. But if we deliver that message in a way such as, child comes home from school one day, gets 75% on a test they worked hard at, and they come home and they're happy, and then mum or dad says, okay, great, 75% is cool, next time make sure you get 80%. All that child hears is, so I'm not enough even when I try my hardest. That's the message that lands with them. So if that happens over and over again through that very vulnerable period, because the emotional brain is very absorbent between the ages of about 4 or 5, 5 or 6 years old to about 14 or 15, a child's emotional brain is on fire at that point. That's what you remember. It was like, we're a mess as a kid. Everything's about us. We're super sensitive. So a child, therefore, doesn't have that adult calculated logic that was intended. They just internalize how that message made them feel. So if that happens over and over and over again, the message then starts to imply to that child at an unconscious level, I am not enough unless I am getting a better result every single time. So then we take that into the rat race, and it goes round and round and round. And then we wonder why we, when we get a promotion, why we still don't feel good enough, because that's exactly how mum and dad made us feel the first time we ever experienced that trauma. And then we're left lost, and we're left confused, and we're left underwhelmed. So then we try to seek pleasures in other things. And this is why so many of these women will drink a lot. And this is why so many of these women will rely on food, because they don't really realize that they've got everything. They've got the house, they've got the car, they've got the husband, they've got the kids, they've got the job, but something still isn't there. It's because that stuff hasn't really been investigated yet.
Well, there's so much there. And by the way, how old is Teddy now?
She's just on the brink of 11 months old.
11 months. So you have a daughter who's now 11 months old. We'll talk about parenting. I'm sure this has been something that's been really prevalent in your line of thought over the last while, about how you want her relationship with food to be and things down this line. But what I actually want to dive into is this professional female who ties a lot of her self-worth to her position and her authority and her power, and ultimately still does not feel fulfilled.
Yeah.
This is a personal take on this that I would like your perspective on. I have personally found, through dieting to extremes, either way, absolutely restricting versus not at all, that neither of those tend to happen when someone is intrinsically happy. When you are a happy individual, when you have comfort, you are stable, you go to bed at night without anxiety, worries, you are comfortable in your own skin, it seems to have this knock-on effect to improve that relationship with food, whether you try to or not. I think it's too simplistic to say to people, just make yourself happy and then your relationship with food will be solved. It is too simplistic. Yeah, but from my personal experience, I have found that to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
That when you relax, when you are able to almost detach, you become much more rational in your line of thinking, and food becomes less of a it seems less loud in your world. It's less, you're less food focused.
Mm-hmm.
But how can you tell someone, just do things that make you happy? Just be happy.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah, it needs to. One thing that I hate about this, because I don't know if I fit into the fitness industry or the self-help industry or both, but one thing that I loathe about the self-help industry is that it's so full of people just telling other people to be nice to themselves. You know, it's like, Jesus Christ, man, I would if I could, you know? Everyone wants to be kind to themselves. And I think the self-help industry generally gets it the wrong way around, because what I find the self-help industry does is they try to drill in this idea of compassion, and then people are left baffled and then feeling even worse about themselves when all these other people seem to find compassion and I can't, just like a diet. Why can all these other people lose weight and I can't? And what people will say, so-called experts and coaches, we'll say, you know, write down some affirmations, write down some gratitudes, and then you'll be able to have some compassion for yourself. And that stuff can have its place. It can have its value. It's massively overvalued, in my humble opinion, because what people don't, the way round that it goes is people will say, well, do the gratitudes, do the affirmations, and that's essentially giving yourself compassion. Just think differently. And again, that you can't undermine human psychology. If you've thought, if you've hated yourself, no matter what you've done for the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 plus years, if you tell yourself that you're a good person or a beautiful person or whatever you're trying to strive for, it's bullshit to you. So you're not going to believe it. It's nonsense, even if it's objectively true. And everybody else can see it, but you can't. To you, it's nonsense. So it's a lie at that point. And this is what I mean when I say people get it the wrong way around, is that compassion for most coaches in this industry is the starting point. My point is that it needs to be the end result. You get to compassion. And the only way you can get to compassion is by truly understanding why you have a lack of compassion for yourself in the first place. You don't always have to do that. Sometimes you can stumble upon it. You know, happy days, that's what a lot of it sounds like. What that's might have been what you did, you know. I bumped into an old friend at the gym. I hadn't seen her in years. And when I did know her, she was always dieting. But she was always in a position where, first of all, she was never happy with her body. Her body was always larger in size, and, you know, internally she wasn't happy as well. Now, I'm not equating a smaller frame to happiness, but she was in a smaller frame, not because she was trying, but because, similar to what you just said, she just had found something where it could have been she just had a child herself. It could have been that she found a new purpose in something else. I know she started her own business. She could have found a purpose in that. The point is that this focus on this end result of looking a certain way wasn't so prominent. And the irony in that is that she could finally have a bit of compassion for herself. So that lens was just, the focus on it was just not so prominent. And what we need to do is, If we want to have that type of compassion for ourselves, there's various steps to doing it. For some people, it's therapy. For some people, it's you know, a program like what we do. Some people could do it by themselves. It's hard. It's hard because naturally, the person that is it, if people's ears have like perked up listening to this, chances are that you are a perfectionist. And that means that if you don't get it perfect, you'll throw it in the bin and call yourself a failure, which is why it's so important to have the right accountability on yourself.
I don't mean to interrupt over there, but it's also really hard to see things objectively when you're in your own head.
Yeah, man.
This
yeah.
is sometimes like we, and this is where mentorship of any kind comes in, because it's very hard when you're in here, I'm pointing to my head all the time. It's very hard to see the bird's eye view of what's actually going on, because yeah, you're aware of the internal dialogue all the time. Sorry, carry on.
No, absolutely. It's not impossible, But in that millisecond, it is impossible because your brain's doing what it's designed to, because whatever has happened is something's triggered the hell out of you. So the blood flows straight to your emotional brain. That's what it's supposed to do. It's what saved us millions of years ago. So bringing it back to the point we had earlier, we still have that Paleolithic brain, except we don't have the environment of something trying to kill us around every corner that the brain perceives it to have. But our brain treats it that way as a consequence. So this is why we're so stressed all the time. So your brain is flooding you with all of these negative stories that are just bullshit, but to you it's true. So it's important to check in with yourself. It's important to practice thinking objectively. It's important to practice it over and over and over again. I think a lot of the time, what a lot of coaches, and I know we're digressing slightly, but I don't think it matters. I think what a lot of coaches get wrong, coaches, not people, not clients, coaches, is they have this perception that they have to be perfect themselves and they're scared to be vulnerable. And don't get me wrong, you'll get some pillocks in the comment sections or potential clients who say, oh, you're struggling with something? Oh, I'm not going to come to you. I need somebody who is absolutely perfect. That person doesn't exist. So if you want somebody who has been through hell, because that's the only way that you believe they're going to empathize with you as a client, don't expect them to be absolutely perfect as well, because that person doesn't exist on planet Earth. If you have gone through hell and back and you have made your way through it somehow and you have managed all of that trauma, you're just very, very good at managing it. You haven't gotten rid of the trauma, because that's not a thing. It doesn't exist in human psychology. It's just management. Sorry, what was the point that we were on before we digressed?
Sorry, and you haven't digressed at all. This was actually a question I wanted to ask you. In jest, I often ask my clients, do they want good cop or bad cop for whatever situation it may be? And by that, in a gentle way, I'm asking about the difference between compassion and discipline. And how do the two complement each other? Can they complement each other? And at what point do we sometimes have to draw a line under the compassion and take action? Is there such a thing? And do you feel that we lean one way or the other too much, either as a society or within our own heads?
That's an awesome question. I've asked myself this many times before, and the conclusion that I've come to with discipline is that I'm not the biggest fan of it. Now, hear me out. Discipline is important. You are not going to get to where you need to internally without doing things that feel uncomfortable. Happiness, fulfillment is on the other side of fear. It has to be. Nobody got to where they wanted to be through comfort. That person doesn't exist. But my point is this, is that coming back to the perfectionist conversation that we had before, I see, you know, discipline is really trendy. And I just think we just have to be a little bit careful about how we implement that discipline. Because a lot of the time, let's say you've struggled with food your entire life, and then you finally found something that means that you are suddenly on track, you know, the weight's coming off, and everything on paper is going really, really well. If we're not careful, what we're actually doing is we're just replacing the unhealthy coping mechanisms with a healthy coping mechanism. Now, that's better. You know, if you're going to choose one of the two, then choose the healthy one, of course. But like the example I used before, where, you know, a very unhappy couple will have a child, it's just a distraction from the feelings that you still haven't addressed. So what could be happening is you're doing this thing, and even though on paper you're getting all of these compliments from people, and as a consequence, because you value other people's opinions and you've been a people pleaser your whole life, you then feel absolutely fantastic. So then you're blissfully unaware of the negative emotions that were so prominent in your life before, but you're just distracted. And it could be distracting you away from this perfectionism, this thing where when I, So I think about this when I think about David Goggins. So everyone knows who David Goggins is these days, right?
I
And
listened to him on the Stairmaster.
yeah, so like I love David Goggins. I think he's crazy. But this is the conversation that I've been having. Like, if I was to have a conversation with him, I would ask the question. The thing is, David, what you've done is unfathomable. The mentality that you must have is unbelievable. But if you were not to do those things, would you feel enough as a human? And I'd be really curious as to what his answer would be. Because if the answer is no, I can't help but feel that, well, you're only doing this to escape sitting with something that you haven't sat with before, you know? And I think that's where a lot of people sit with discipline. So I think it's absolutely necessary. When I do my cold dips, I need discipline to do that because I hate it every single time. So there are certain things that you have to. Maybe it's a case of reframing the language. I don't know. Sometimes I think that can be a bit patronizing. So it depends on the person. But I think discipline is necessary. It's just be wary of whether
Replacing.
you're replacing something. You're just distracting from unhealed wounds. And this is bloody prominent in the fitness industry because it's so a good body is so praised. And when we have more likes and more followers and this, that, and the other, it's just the happiness is then just recycled, but it is just dopamine. So it's going to drop. What goes up with dopamine, it has to come back down again. That's not true fulfillment. That's happiness. They're two completely different things. We don't want happy. Happy is fickle. It comes, it goes. We want this acceptance. Now, I think the question that you've kind of asked, and if you haven't, you're going to ask me is, but if somebody is in a really sort of crippling position, we can't just tell them that that's okay because they might die early. They feel miserable, and I agree with that. So that's the balance that we have to find. And I don't really know how I still would phrase that to somebody. I know how I feel about it. How would I formulate it? I'm not entirely sure. It's a case of having enough discipline that is you are promising something to this future version of yourself, but not so much that you are completely dismissing and undermining everything that's actually happening internally. I think that's how best I would try to balance it.
To me, it's almost like a mental tightrope. So we always want to be moving forward, but we don't want to lean too much one way or the other. And I think we have to be really, really clued up in the fact that, and I know I say it in jest, but different people need different things on different days. The same person needs a different thing on a different day to keep that momentum going. And I think you're exactly right. It all comes down to awareness. How well do you know yourself? How well do you know what you actually need at that given time and what actually makes you tick? I think I'm conscious of the time, Bobby, and I want to ask you this quite important question. If someone is listening to this and they think, I agree with everything you've just said. You are speaking to me. You've really, really seen me. And so much of what you're describing here, I can personally relate to. I've experienced this. If someone's sitting there and thinking, yes, I acknowledge fundamentally I have a poor relationship with food, but I want to change it. I don't always want it to be like this. I can see a distant future somewhere where I don't have this draw to food, this need to fill this void with food. I want to start making a change. How do they go about doing that? What practical things, whether it be mindset-based, whether it be logistical, physical things, what can you do to start on that journey?
It's such a, people are going to hate this answer, but it's going to be how can you prioritize yourself more? And what do you truly, truly want for yourself? That sounds really obvious on paper, and it's probably what every Joe Bloggs would tell you. So let me try and dive deeper. When we want something, we often believe it's what we want because we've never questioned it. And it probably comes back to the rat race conversation that we mentioned earlier. So a better question to ask yourself is take a moment to, and people can get really emotional when they go through this exercise. Sometimes not, because sometimes we're not quite ready for that. Sometimes we're in a very logical state. We're very cynical. And I get that because I was that person. But if we're ready to have this conversation with ourselves, if we can picture that little child that we completely have ignored for the last, whatever it is, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, because we've been so distracted by life. If we can take it back to her or him and picture them, you know, what clothes do they have on? What room are they in? What are they struggling with? What's the dynamic like in the household? Is it chaotic? Is it peaceful? What were you ridiculed for as a child? What did you feel pressured for as a child? So in a roundabout way, what I'm trying to say is that I think from an ego perspective, our ego tells us that we know what we want, but we've never really questioned who planted that seed there. And a lot of the time, who we are and what we value and what we think we want is simply a byproduct of that seed that was planted many, many years ago. And the point is that it's okay to challenge that bias that we have. So the more that we can try to take it truly to that little person, because what I find is that when we speak to that little person, it can blow our minds a little, and we're great at talking terribly to ourselves. When you reframe that to the little version of yourself, you can't speak nastily to that person. And you'll realize that the more questions that you ask of that little person, first of all, you realize how nasty you've probably been to him or her all of these years, because that's who you're talking to every time that you criticize yourself in the mirror or you haven't got the promotion that you wanted. But when we take it back to them, we can have a slightly different perspective, or rather, we get a more articulate idea of why we've made the choices that we have, whether it be career, relationships, whatever. And then once we understand that, we can then start to be a bit more objective and then track back along the timeline to see, maybe if I did that differently, I wouldn't be this person today. Maybe I don't have to do things the way that I always have. Maybe everything that I feel about myself, it is just a byproduct and a consequence of how I was raised, of how I was bullied. Maybe I'm just protecting myself from the unbearable pain of letting mum and dad down again, because they wanted me to be perfect. But, you know, this is my life. So I would start by speaking to that little kid. That's what I would do.
Even with you, the narrative there, I can hear the way that I would talk to a child in my head versus how I speak to myself.
Mm-hmm.
They're two totally different people.
Yeah.
Totally different people. We are so hard on ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, we are. We find it so easy to be critical of ourselves and this is where I can feel a bit, because I'm not a woo-woo guy. I don't consider myself particularly spiritual. I'm still trying to search for what spirituality even means to me, because I think it can mean something different to everyone. And this is why it took me so long to get on board with this way of thinking, because it sat in this what I would call like a woo-woo group. You know, it was very out there. But I take a very objective neurological nervous system perspective. And that's the truth, is that our nervous system right now, whenever you look in the mirror and you are like, oh, you fat cow, like, why have you done it again? You know that you shouldn't be, you're not helping yourself. You know that you want to lose weight, yet you're still eating that chocolate again. Look at yourself. You're the example of what what a successful dieter shouldn't be. But this is the thing, is that psychologically, we can't possibly react to the situation that's in front of us. That's why kids don't have any perspective. That's why they're oblivious to life, because they haven't got any context of life yet. They don't have perspective. They don't have comparison. We as adults do. We've got a history to compare every current moment to. So what we're actually doing unconsciously is we're not reacting to this situation that's right in front of us. We're reacting to what this situation is unconsciously reminding us from in our past, whether it be childhood or what have you. So when we're chastising ourselves, it's not that person that we're chastising. It's that little kid. That little kid is still very, very much inside us, and that nervous system is still very much there as well.
Yeah. Bobby, on those grounds then, do you believe fundamentally that everyone can change their relationship with food for the better?
100%. I'm not just saying that to blow smoke. I don't blow smoke up people's asses. You know, I'm a very truthful, very raw, very honest person. Everybody, the deeper the trauma, the more difficult it is. But we've worked with women in their 50s and 60s in cases, and we've helped them manage their trauma in 6 months relative to the fact they've been living with that for 40, 50 years. 6 months. You just have to know how. 100%, no denying it. It can be more difficult, but yes, sure is the short answer.
Yeah, I think so. For anyone listening who feels this has been a lifelong, for a lot of people, it's this lifelong burden. It can often feel like that as well. It can often feel like this extra weight, sorry, excuse me, but that you're carrying around, because it feels like that. Because it is, it's a stress, it's anxiety inducing, it's a heavy load to carry. To know that there are strategies, there are tools, there are people that can help you work through this. Like, there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. I'm sure you'd be the first one to say that there's no blanket follow this five-step method to correct your lifetime with food. However, there are things that you can do. I think there's a couple of things that I would suggest women do is you need to be willing, you need to be open, and you need to want to be helped. I think you need to want to be helped. Bobby, I'm going to say thank you so much for your time today. I'm going to link all of your contact details below. So if anyone does want to find you, if they want to reach out and get in touch, I know you would be more than happy to answer any questions.
Of course, yeah.
Honestly, thank you so much for your insight. I really appreciate your time today. We could go on like this forever. I'm absolutely sure. Thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Caroline. Absolute pleasure.